As soon as we started out on the road outside of town, it was cool. It felt nice riding high up and close under the trees. The bus went quite fast and made a good breeze, and as we went out along the road with the dust powdering the trees and down the hill, we had a fine view, back through the trees, of the town rising up from the bluff above the river. The Basque, lying against my knees, pointed out the view with the neck of the wine bottle and winked at us. He nodded his head. "Pretty nice, eh?"
"These Basques are swell people," Bill said.
The Basque lying against my legs was tanned the color of saddle leather. He wore a black smock, like all the rest. There were wrinkles in his tanned neck. He turned around and offered his wine bag to Bill. Bill handed him one of our bottles. The Basque wagged a forefinger at him and handed the bottle back, slapping in the cork with the palm of his hand. He shoved the wine bag up.
"Arriba! Arriba!" he said. "Lift it up."
Bill raised the wine skin and let the stream of wine spurt out and into his mouth, his head tipped back. When he stopped drinking and tipped the leather bottle down, a few drops ran down his chin.
"No, no," several Basques said. "Not like that."
One snatched the bottle away from the owner, who was himself about to give a demonstration. He was a young fellow, and he held the wine bottle at full arm's length and raised it high up, squeezing the leather bag with his hand so the stream of wine hissed into his mouth. He held the bag out there, the wine making a flat, hard trajectory into his mouth, and he kept on swallowing smoothly and regularly.
"Hey," the owner of the bottle shouted, "whose wine is that?"
The drinker waggled his little finger at him and smiled at us with his eyes. Then he bit the stream off sharp, made a quick lift with the wine bag, and lowered it down to the owner. He winked at us. The owner shook the wineskin sadly. We passed through a town and stopped in front of the posada, and the driver took on several packages. Then we started on again, and outside the town the road commenced to mount. We were going through farming country with rocky hills that sloped down into the fields. The grain fields went up the hillsides. Now as we went higher, there was a wind blowing the grain. The road was white and dusty, and the dust rose under the wheels and hung in the air behind us. The road climbed up into the hills and left the rich grain fields below. Now there were only patches of grain on the bare hillsides and on each side of the watercourses. We turned sharply out to the side of the road to give room to pass to a long string of six mules, following one after the other, hauling a high hooded wagon loaded with freight. The wagon and the mules were covered with dust. Close behind was another string of mules and another wagon. This was loaded with lumber, and the arriero, driving the mules, leaned back and put on the thick wooden brakes as we passed. Up here the country was quite barren, and the hills were rocky and hard-baked clay, furrowed by the rain. We came around a curve into a town, and on both sides opened out a sudden green valley. A stream went through the center of the town, and fields of grapes touched the houses. The bus stopped in front of a posada, and many of the passengers got down, and a lot of the baggage was unstrapped from the roof from under the big tarpaulins and lifted down. Bill and I got down and went into the posada. There was a low, dark room with saddles and harness and hay forks made of white wood and clusters of canvas rope-soled shoes and hams and slabs of bacon and white garlics and long sausages hanging from the roof. It was cool and dusky, and we stood in front of a long wooden counter with two women behind it serving drinks. Behind them were shelves stacked with supplies and goods. We each had an aguardiente and paid 40 centimes for the two drinks. I gave the woman 50 centimes to make a tip, and she gave me back the copper piece, thinking I had misunderstood the price. Two of our Basques came in and insisted on buying a drink, so they bought a drink, and then we bought a drink, and then they slapped us on the back and bought another drink, then we bought, and then we all went out into the sunlight and the heat and climbed back on top of the bus. There was plenty of room now for everyone to sit on the seat, and the Basque who had been lying on the tin roof now sat between us. The woman who had been serving drinks came out wiping her hands on her apron and talked to somebody inside the bus. Then the driver came out, swinging two flat leather mail pouches, and climbed up, and everybody waving, we started off. The road left the Green Valley at once, and we were up in the hills again. Bill and the wine bottle Basque were having a conversation. A man leaned over from the other side of the seat and asked in English, "You're Americans?" "Sure." "I've been there," he said, 40 years ago. He was an old man, as brown as the others, with the stubble of a white beard. "How was it?"
"What you say?"
"How was America?"
"Oh, I was in California. It was fine."
"Why did you leave?"
"What you say?"
"Why did you come back here?"
"Oh, I come back to get married. I was going to go back, but my wife, she don't like to travel. Where you from?"
"Kansas City."
"I been there," he said. "I been in Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, Denver, Los Angeles, Salt Lake City."
He named them carefully. "How long were you over?"
15 years. "Then I come back and got married."
"Have a drink?"
"All right," he said. "You can't get this in America, eh?"
"There's plenty if you can pay for it."
"What you come over here for?"
"We're going to the fiesta at Pamplona."
"You like the bullfights?"
"Sure, don't you?"
"Yes," he said. "I guess I like them."
Then after a while,
"Where you go now?"
"Up to Burguete to fish."
"Well," he said, "I hope you catch something."
He shook hands and turned around to the back seat again. The other Basques had been impressed. He sat back comfortably and smiled at me when I turned around to look at the country. But the effort of talking American seemed to have tired him. He did not say anything after that. The bus climbed steadily up the road. The country was barren and rocks stuck up through the clay. There was no grass beside the road. Looking back, we could see the country spread out below. Far back, the fields were squares of green and brown on the hillsides. Making the horizon were the brown mountains. They were strangely shaped. As we climbed higher, the horizon kept changing. As the bus ground slowly up the road, we could see other mountains coming up in the south. Then the road came over the crest, flattened out, and went into a forest. It was a forest of cork oaks, and the sun came through the trees in patches, and there were cattle grazing back in the trees. We went through the forest, and the road came out and turned along a rise of land, and out ahead of us was a rolling green plain with dark mountains beyond it. These were not like the brown heat-baked mountains we had left behind. These were wooded, and there were clouds coming down from them. The green plain stretched off. It was cut by fences, and the white of the road showed through the trunks of a double line of trees that crossed the plain toward the north. As we came to the edge of the rise, we saw the red roofs and the white houses of Burguete ahead strung out on the plain And away off on the shoulder of the first dark mountain was the gray, metal-sheathed roof of the monastery of Roncesvalles. "There's Roncevaux," I said.
"Where?"
"Way off there, where the mountain starts."
"It's cold up here," Bill said.
"It's high," I said. "It must be 1,200 meters."
"It's awful cold," Bill said.
The bus leveled down onto the straight line of road that ran to Burguete. We passed a crossroads and crossed a bridge over a stream. The houses of Burguete were along both sides of the road. There were no side streets. We passed the church and the schoolyard, and the bus stopped. We got down, and the driver handed down our bags and the rod case. A carabinier in his cocked hat and yellow leather cross-straps came up.
"What's in that?"
He pointed to the rod case. I opened it and showed him. He asked to see our fishing permits, and I got them out. He looked at the date and then waved us on.
"Is that all right?" I asked.
"Yes, of course."
We went up the street past the whitewashed stone houses, families sitting in their doorways watching us, to the inn. The fat woman who ran the inn came out from the kitchen and shook hands with us. She took off her spectacles, wiped them, and put them on again. It was cold in the inn, and the wind was starting to blow outside. The woman sent a girl upstairs with us to show the room. There were two beds, a washstand, a clothes chest, and a big framed steel engraving of Nuestra Señora de Roncesvalles. The wind was blowing against the shutters. The room was on the north side of the inn. We washed, put on sweaters, and came downstairs into the dining room. It had a stone floor, low ceiling, and was oak-paneled. The shutters were all up, and it was so cold you could see your breath.
"My God," said Bill, "it can't be this cold tomorrow. I'm not going to wade a stream in this weather."
There was an upright piano in the far corner of the room beyond the wooden tables, and Bill went over and started to play.
"I gotta keep warm," he said.
I went out to find the woman and ask her how much the room and board was. She put her hands under her apron and looked away from me.
12 pesetas.
"Why, we only paid that in Pamplona." She did not say anything, just took off her glasses and wiped them on her apron. "That's too much," I said. "We didn't pay more than that at a big hotel."
"We put in a bathroom."
"Haven't you got anything cheaper?"
"Not in the summer. Now is the big season."
We were the only people in the inn. "Well, I thought it's only a few days. Is the wine included?"
"Oh, yes."
"Well," I said, "it's all right." I went back to Bill. He blew his breath at me to show how cold it was and went on playing. I sat at one of the tables and looked at the pictures on the wall. There was one panel of rabbits, dead, one of pheasants, also dead, and one panel of dead ducks. The panels were all dark and smoky-looking. There was a cupboard full of liqueur bottles. I looked at them all. Bill was still playing.
"How about a hot rum punch?" he said. "This isn't going to keep me warm permanently."
I went out and told the woman what a rum punch was and how to make it. In a few minutes, a girl brought a stone pitcher steaming into the room. Bill came over from the piano, and we drank the hot punch and listened to the wind.
"There isn't too much rum in that."
I went over to the cupboard and brought the rum bottle and poured a half tumblerful into the pitcher.
"Direct action," said Bill. "It beats legislation."
The girl came in and laid the table for supper.
"It blows like hell up here," Bill said.
The girl brought in a big bowl of hot vegetable soup and the wine. We had fried trout afterward and some sort of a stew and a big bowl full of wild strawberries. We did not lose money on the wine, and the girl was shy but nice about bringing it. The old woman looked in once and counted the empty bottles. After supper, we went upstairs and smoked and read in bed to keep warm. Once in the night, I woke and heard the wind blowing. It felt good to be warm and in bed. Chapter 12. When I woke in the morning, I went to the window and looked out. It had cleared, and there were no clouds on the mountains. Outside, under the window, were some carts and an old diligence. The wood of the roof cracked and split by the weather. It must have been left from the days before the motor buses. A goat hopped up on one of the carts and then to the roof of the diligence. He jerked his head at the other goats below, and when I waved at him, he bounded down. Bill was still sleeping, so I dressed, put on my shoes outside in the hall, and went downstairs. No one was stirring downstairs, so I unbolted the door and went out. It was cool outside in the early morning, and the sun had not yet dried the dew that had come when the wind died down. I hunted around in the shed behind the inn and found a sort of mattock, and went down toward the stream to try and dig some worms for bait. The stream was clear and shallow, but it did not look trouty. On the grassy bank where it was damp, I drove the mattock into the earth and loosened a chunk of sod. There were worms underneath. They slid out of sight as I lifted the sod, and I dug carefully and got a good many. Digging at the edge of the damp ground, I filled two empty tobacco tins with worms and sifted dirt onto them. The goats watched me dig. When I went back into the inn, the woman was down in the kitchen, and I asked her to get coffee for us and that we wanted a lunch. Bill was awake and sitting on the edge of the bed.
"I saw you out of the window," he said. "Didn't want to interrupt you. What were you doing? Burying your money?"
"You lazy bum."
"Been working for the common good? Splendid. I want you to do that every morning."
"Come on," I said, "get up."
"What? Get up? I never get up."
He climbed into bed and pulled a sheet up to his chin.
"Try and argue me into getting up."
I went on looking for the tackle and putting it all together in the tackle bag.
"Aren't you interested?" Bill asked.
"I'm going down and eat."
"Eat? Why didn't you say eat? I thought you just wanted me to get up for fun." "Eat? Fine. Now you're reasonable. You go out and dig some more worms, and I'll be right down."
"Oh, go to hell."
"Work for the good of all."
Bill stepped into his underclothes.
"Show irony and pity."
I started out of the room with the tackle bag, the nets, and the rod case.
"Hey, come back."
I put my head in the door.
"Aren't you going to show a little irony and pity?"
I thumbed my nose.
"That's not irony."
As I went downstairs, I heard Bill singing,
"Irony and pity when you're feeling, oh, give them irony and give them pity. Oh, give them irony when they're feeling, just a little irony, just a little pity."
He kept on singing until he came downstairs. I was reading a week-old Spanish paper.
"What's all this irony and pity?"
"What? Don't you know about irony and pity?"
"No. Who got it up?"
"Everybody. They're mad about it in New York. It's just like the Fratellinis used to be."
The girl came in with the coffee and buttered toast. Or rather, it was bread toasted and buttered.
"Ask her if she's got any jam," Bill said. "Be ironical with her."
"Have you got any jam?"
"That's not ironical. I wish I could talk Spanish."
The coffee was good, and we drank it out of big bowls. The girl brought in a glass dish of raspberry jam. "Thank you.
Hey, that's not the way, Bill said. Say something ironical. Make some crack about Primo de Rivera.
I could ask her what kind of jam they think they've gotten into in the riff.
Poor, said Bill. Very poor. You can't do it. That's all. You don't understand irony. You have no pity. Say something pitiful.
Robert Cohn.
Not so bad. That's better.
Now, why is Cohn pitiful?
Be ironic.
He took a big gulp of coffee. Oh, hell, I said, it's too early in the morning.
There you go, and you claim you want to be a writer, too. You're only a newspaper man, an expatriated newspaper man. You ought to be ironical the minute you get out of bed. You ought to wake up with your mouth full of pity.
Go on, I said. Who do you get this stuff from?
Everybody. Don't you read? Don't you ever see anybody? You know what you are. You're an expatriate. Why don't you live in New York? Then you'd know these things. What do you want me to do? Come over here and tell you every year?
Take some more coffee, I said.
Good. Coffee is good for you. It's the caffeine in it. Caffeine, we are here. Caffeine puts a man on her horse and a woman in his grave. You know what's the trouble with you? You're an expatriate. One of the worst type. Haven't you heard that? Nobody that ever left their own country ever wrote anything worth printing, not even in the newspapers.
He drank the coffee.
You're an expatriate. You've lost touch with the soil. You get precious. Fake European standards have ruined you. You drink yourself to death. You become obsessed by sex. You spend all your time talking, not working. You're an expatriate, see? You hang around cafes.
He sounds like a swell life, I said. When do I work?
You don't work. One group claims women support you, another group claims you're impotent.
No, I said, I just had an accident.
Never mention that, Bill said. That's the sort of thing that can't be spoken of. That's what you ought to work up into a mystery, like Henry's bicycle.
He had been going splendidly, but he stopped. I was afraid he thought he had hurt me with that crack about being impotent. I wanted to start him again. It wasn't a bicycle, I said. He was riding horseback.
I heard it was a tricycle.
Well, I said, a plane is sort of like a tricycle. The joystick works the same way.
But you don't pedal it.
No, I said, I guess you don't pedal it.
Let's lay off that, Bill said.
All right, I was just standing up for the tricycle.
I think he's a good writer, too, Bill said. And you're a hell of a good guy. Anybody ever tell you you were a good guy?
I'm not a good guy.
Listen, you're a hell of a good guy, and I'm fonder of you than anybody on earth. I couldn't tell you that in New York. It'd mean I was a faggot. That was what the Civil War was about. Abraham Lincoln was a faggot. He was in love with General Grant. So was Jefferson Davis. Lincoln just freed the slaves on a bet. The Dred Scott case was framed by the Anti-Saloon League. Sex explains it all. The Colonel's lady and Judy O'Grady are lesbians under their skin.
He stopped.
Want to hear some more?
Shoot, I said.
I don't know anymore. Tell you some more at lunch. Oh, Bill, I said. You bum.
We packed the lunch and two bottles of wine in the rucksack, and Bill put it on. I carried the rod case and the landing net slung over my back. We started up the road and then went across a meadow and found a path that crossed the fields and went toward the woods on the slope of the first hill. We walked across the fields on the sandy path. The fields were rolling and grassy, and the grass was short from the sheep grazing. The cattle were up in the hills. We heard their bells in the woods. The path crossed a stream on a footlog. The log was surfaced off, and there was a sapling bent across for a rail. In the flat pool beside the stream, tadpoles spotted the sand. We went up a steep bank and across the rolling fields. Looking back, we saw Burghete, white houses and red roofs, and the white road with a truck going along it and the dust rising. Beyond the fields, we crossed another faster-flowing stream. A sandy road led down to the ford and beyond into the woods. The path crossed the stream on another footlog below the ford and joined the road, and we went into the woods. It was a beech wood, and the trees were very old. Their roots bulked above the ground, and the branches were twisted. We walked on the road between the thick trunks of the old beeches, and the sunlight came through the leaves in light patches on the grass. The trees were big, and the foliage was thick, but it was not gloomy. There was no undergrowth, only the smooth grass, very green and fresh, and the big gray trees, well spaced, as though it were a park. "This is country," Bill said. The road went up a hill, and we got into thick woods, and the road kept on climbing. Sometimes it dipped down but rose again steeply. All the time we heard the cattle in the woods. Finally, the road came out on top of the hills. We were on the top of the height of land that was the highest part of the range of wooded hills we had seen from Burghete. There were wild strawberries growing on the sunny side of the ridge in a little clearing in the trees. Ahead, the road came out of the forest and went along the shoulder of the ridge of hills. The hills ahead were not wooded, and there were great fields of yellow gorse. Way off, we saw the steep bluffs, dark with trees and jutting with gray stone, that marked the course of the Irati River. "We have to follow this road along the ridge, cross these hills, go through the woods on the far hills, and come down to the Irati Valley," I pointed out to Bill.
"That's a hell of a hike."
"It's too far to go and fish and come back the same day comfortably."
"Comfortably? That's a nice word.
We'll have to go like hell to get there and back and have any fishing at all." It was a long walk, and the country was very fine. But we were tired when we came down the steep road that led out of the wooded hills into the valley of the Rio de la Fabrica. The road came out from the shadow of the woods into the hot sun. Ahead was a river valley. Beyond the river was a steep hill. There was a field of buckwheat on the hill. We saw a white house under some trees on the hillside. It was very hot, and we stopped under some trees beside a dam that crossed the river. Bill put the pack against one of the trees, and we jointed up the rods, put on the reels, tied on leaders, and got ready to fish.
"You're sure this thing has trout in it?" Bill asked.
"It's full of them."
"I'm going to fish a fly. You got any McGinnies?"
"There's some in there."
"You going to fish bait?"
"Yeah, I'm going to fish the dam here."
"Well, I'll take the fly book then."
He tied on a fly.
"Where'd I better go, up or down?"
"Down is the best. There are plenty up above, too." Bill went down the bank.
"Take a worm can." "No, I don't want one. If they won't take a fly, I'll just flick it around."
Bill was down below watching the stream.
"Say," he called up against the noise of the dam, "how about putting the wine in that spring up the road?"
"All right," I shouted.
Bill waved his hand and started down the stream. I found the two wine bottles in the pack and carried them up the road to where the water of a spring flowed out of an iron pipe. There was a board over the spring, and I lifted it and, knocking the corks firmly into the bottles, lowered them down into the water. It was so cold my hand and wrist felt numbed. I put back the slab of wood and hoped nobody would find the wine. I got my rod that was leaning against the tree, took the bait can and landing net, and walked out onto the dam. It was built to provide a head of water for driving logs. The gate was up, and I sat on one of the squared timbers and watched the smooth apron of water before the river tumbled into the falls. In the white water at the foot of the dam, it was deep. As I baited up, a trout shot up out of the white water into the falls and was carried down. Before I could finish baiting, another trout jumped at the falls, making the same lovely arc and disappearing into the water that was thundering down. I put on a good-sized sinker and dropped into the white water close to the edge of the timbers of the dam. I did not feel the first trout strike. When I started to pull up, I felt that I had one, and brought him, fighting and bending the rod almost double, out of the boiling water at the foot of the falls and swung him up and onto the dam. He was a good trout, and I banged his head against the timber so that he quivered out straight and then slipped him into my bag. While I had him on, several trout had jumped at the falls. As soon as I baited up and dropped in again, I hooked another and brought him in the same way. In a little while, I had six. They were all about the same size. I laid them out, side by side, all their heads pointing the same way, and looked at them. They were beautifully colored, and firm, and hard from the cold water. It was a hot day, so I slit them all, and shucked out the insides, gills and all, and tossed them over across the river. I took the trout ashore, washed them in the cold, smoothly heavy water above the dam, and then picked some ferns and packed them all in the bag, three trout on a layer of ferns, then another layer of ferns, then three more trout, and then covered them with ferns. They looked nice in the ferns. And now the bag was bulky, and I put it in the shade of the tree. It was very hot on the dam, so I put my worm can in the shade with the bag and got a book out of the pack and settled down under the tree to read until Bill should come up for lunch. It was a little past noon, and there was not much shade, but I sat against the trunk of two of the trees that grew together and read. The book was something by A.E. W. Mason. And I was reading a wonderful story about a man who had been frozen in the Alps and then fallen into a glacier and disappeared, and his bride was going to wait 24 years exactly for his body to come out on the moraine, while her true love waited too, and they were still waiting when Bill came up.
"Get any?"
he asked. He had his rod and his bag and his net all in one hand, and he was sweating. I hadn't heard him come up because of the noise from the dam. "Six, what did you get?" Bill sat down, opened up his bag, laid a big trout on the grass. He took out three more, each one a little bigger than the last, and laid them side by side in the shade from the tree. His face was sweaty and happy.
"How are yours?"
"Smaller."
"Let's see them."
"They're packed."
"How big are they, really?"
"They're all about the size of your smallest."
"You're not holding out on me."
"I wish I were."
"Get them all on worms?"
"Yes."
"You lazy bum."
Bill put the trout in the bag and started for the river, swinging the open bag. He was wet from the waist down, and I knew he must have been wading the stream. I walked up the road and got out the two bottles of wine. They were cold. Moisture beaded on the bottles as I walked back to the trees. I spread the lunch on a newspaper and uncorked one of the bottles and leaned the other against a tree. Bill came up, drying his hands, his bag plump with ferns.
"Let's see that bottle," he said.
He pulled the cork and tipped up the bottle and drank.
"Oh, that makes my eyes ache."
"Let's try it." The wine was icy cold and tasted faintly rusty.
"That's not such filthy wine," Bill said.
"The cold helps it," I said. We unwrapped the little parcels of lunch.
"Chicken. There's hard-boiled eggs.
Find any salt?"
"First the egg," said Bill. "Then the chicken. Even Brian could see that. He's dead. I read it in the paper yesterday."
"No, not really."
"Yes, Brian's dead."
Bill laid down the egg he was peeling.
"Gentlemen," he said, and unwrapped a drumstick from a piece of newspaper. "I reverse the order for Brian's sake. As a tribute to the great commoner, first the chicken, then the egg. Wonder what day God created the chicken."
"Oh," said Bill, sucking the drumstick, "how should we know? We should not question. Our stay on earth is not for long. Let us rejoice and believe and give thanks.
Eat an egg." Bill gestured with the drumstick in one hand and the bottle of wine in the other.
"Let us rejoice in our blessings. Let us utilize the fowls of the air. Let us utilize the product of the vine. Will you utilize a little, brother?"
"After you, brother."
Bill took a long drink.
"Utilize a little, brother." He handed me the bottle. "Let us not doubt, brother. Let us not pry into the holy mysteries of the hen coop with simian fingers. Let us accept on faith and simply say, I want you to join with me in saying,
what shall we say, brother?"
He pointed the drumstick at me and went on. "Let me tell you. We will say, and I for one am proud to say, and I want you to say with me on your knees, brother, let no man be ashamed to kneel here in the great out of doors. Remember the woods were God's first temples. Let us kneel and say, don't eat that lady, that's Mankin."
"Here," I said, "utilize a little of this." We uncorked the other bottle. "What's the matter?" I said. "Didn't you like Brian?"
"I love Brian," said Bill. "We were like brothers."
"Where'd you know him?"
"He and Mankin and I all went to Holy Cross together."
"And Frankie Fritsch."
"It's a lie. Frankie Fritsch went to Fordham."
"Well," I said, "I went to Loyola with Bishop Manning."
"It's a lie," Bill said. "I went to Loyola with Bishop Manning myself."
"You're cockeyed," I said.
"On wine?"
"Why not?"
"It's the humidity," Bill said. "They ought to take this damn humidity away."
"Have another shot."
"Is this all we've got?"
"Only the two bottles."
"Do you know what you are?"
Bill looked at the bottle affectionately.
"No," I said. "You're in the pay of the Anti-Saloon League."
"I went to Notre Dame with Wayne B. Wheeler."
"It's a lie," said Bill. "I went to Austin Business College with Wayne B. Wheeler. He was class president."
"Well," I said, "the saloon must go."
"You're right there," old classmate Bill said. "The saloon must go, and I will take it with me."
"You're cockeyed."
"On wine?"
"On wine."
"Well, maybe I am."
"Want to take a nap?"
"All right."
We lay with our heads in the shade and looked up into the trees.
"You asleep?"
"No," Bill said. "I was thinking."
When I shut my eyes, it felt good lying on the ground.
"Say," Bill said, "what about this Brett business?"
"What about it?"
"Were you ever in love with her?"
"Sure."
"For how long?"
"Off and on for a hell of a long time."
"Oh, hell," Bill said. "I'm sorry, fella."
"It's all right," I said.
I don't give a damn anymore.
Really?
Really. Only I'd a hell of a lot rather not talk about it. You aren't sorry I asked you. Why the hell should I be?
I'm going to sleep, Bill said.
He put a newspaper over his face. Listen, Jake, he said. Are you really a Catholic? Technically.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
All right, I'll go to sleep now, he said. Don't keep me awake by talking so much.
I went to sleep, too. When I woke up, Bill was packing the rucksack. It was late in the afternoon, and the shadow from the trees was long and went out over the dam. I was stiff from sleeping on the ground.
What'd you do? Wake up? Bill asked. Why didn't you spend the night?
I stretched and rubbed my eyes.
I had a lovely dream, Bill said. I don't remember what it was about, but it was a lovely dream.
I don't think I dreamt.
You ought to dream, Bill said. All our biggest businessmen have been dreamers. Look at Ford, look at President Coolidge, look at Rockefeller, look at Joe Davidson.
I disjointed my rod and Bill's and packed them in the rod case. I put the reels in the tackle bag. Bill had packed the rucksack, and we put one of the trout bags in. I carried the other.
Well, said Bill, have we got everything?
The worms.
Your worms. Put them in there.
He had the pack on his back, and I put the worm cans in one of the outside flap pockets.
You got everything now?
I looked around on the grass at the foot of the elm trees.
Yes.
We started up the road into the woods. It was a long walk home to Burguete, and it was dark when we came down across the fields to the road, and along the road between the houses of the town, their windows lighted to the inn. We stayed 5 days at Burguete and had good fishing. The nights were cold, and the days were hot, and there was always a breeze even in the heat of the day. It was hot enough so that it felt good to wade in a cold stream. When the sun dried you when you came out and sat on the bank, we found a stream with a pool deep enough to swim in. In the evenings, we played three-handed bridge with an Englishman named Harris who had walked over from Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port and was stopping at the inn for the fishing. He was very pleasant and went with us twice to the Irati River. There was no word from Robert Cohn, nor from Brett and Mike. Chapter 13. One morning I went down to breakfast, and the Englishman, Harris, was already at the table. He was reading the paper through spectacles. He looked up and smiled.
"Good morning," he said. "Letter for you. I stopped at the post, and they gave it me with mine."
The letter was at my place at the table, leaning against a coffee cup. Harris was reading the paper again. I opened the letter. It had been forwarded from Pamplona. It was dated San Sebastian, Sunday.
"Dear Jake, we got here Friday. Brett passed out on the train, so brought her here for 3 days' rest with old friends of ours. We go to Montoya Hotel Pamplona Tuesday, arriving at I don't know what hour. Will you send a note by the bus to tell us what to do to rejoin you all on Wednesday? All our love and sorry to be late, but Brett was really done in and would be quite all right by Tuesday, and is practically so now. I know her so well and try to look after her, but it's not so easy. Love to all the chaps. Michael."
"What day of the week is it?" I asked Harris.
"Wednesday, I think, yes, quite, Wednesday. Wonderful how one loses track of the days up here in the mountains."
"Yes, we've been here nearly a week."
"I hope you're not thinking of leaving."
"Yes, we'll go in on the afternoon bus, I'm afraid."
"What a rotten business. I had hoped we'd all have another go at the Irati together."
"We have to go into Pamplona. We're meeting people there."
"What rotten luck for me. We've had a jolly time here at Burguete."
"Come on in to Pamplona. We can play some bridge there. And there's going to be a damn fine fiesta."
"I'd like to. Awfully nice of you to ask me. I'd best stop on here, though.
I've not much more time to fish.
You want those big ones in the Irrati? I say I do, you know. They're enormous trout there. I'd like to try them once more.
Do. Stop over another day. Be a good chap.
We really have to get into town, I said.
What a pity.
After breakfast, Bill and I were sitting warming in the sun on a bench out in front of the inn and talking it over. I saw a girl coming up the road from the center of the town. She stopped in front of us and took a telegram out of the leather wallet that hung against her skirt.
Por ustedes?
I looked at it. The address was Barnes, Burguete. Yes, it's for us. She brought out a book for me to sign, and I gave her a couple of coppers. The telegram was in Spanish.
Vengo jueves, con.
I handed it to Bill. What does the word cone mean? He asked. What a lousy telegram, I said. He could send 10 words for the same price. I come Thursday. That gives you a lot of dope, doesn't it?
It gives you all the dope that's of interest to Cone.
We're going in anyway, I said. There's no use trying to move Brett and Mike out here and back before the fiesta. Should we answer it?
We might as well, said Bill. There's no need for us to be snooty.
We walked up to the post office and asked for a telegraph blank.
What will we say? Bill asked.
Arriving tonight.
That's enough.
We paid for the message and walked back to the inn. Harris was there, and the three of us walked up to Roncesvalles. We went through the monastery.
It's a remarkable place, Harris said when we came out. But you know, I'm not much on those sort of places.
Me either, Bill said.
It's a remarkable place, though, Harris said.
I wouldn't not have seen it. I'd been intending coming up each day.
It isn't the same as fishing, though, is it? Bill asked.
He liked Harris.
I say not.
We were standing in front of the old chapel of the monastery.
Isn't that a pub across the way? Harris asked.
Or do my eyes deceive me?
It has the look of a pub, Bill said.
It looks to me like a pub, I said.
I say, said Harris, let's utilize it.
He had taken up utilizing from Bill. We had a bottle of wine apiece. Harris would not let us pay. He talked Spanish quite well, and the innkeeper would not take our money.
I say, you don't know what it's meant to me to have you chaps up here.
We have had a grand time, Harris. Harris was a little tight.
I say, really, you don't know how much it means. I've not had much fun since the war.
We'll fish together again sometime. Don't you forget it, Harris.
We must. We have had such a jolly good time.
How about another bottle around?
Jolly good idea, said Harris.
This is mine, said Bill, or we don't drink it.
I wish you'd let me pay for it. It does give me pleasure, you know.
This is going to give me pleasure, Bill said.
The innkeeper brought in the fourth bottle. We had kept the same glasses. Harris lifted his glass.
I say, you know, this does utilize well.
Bill slapped him on the back.
Good old Harris. I say, you know, my name isn't really Harris. It's Wilson Harris, all one name, with the hyphen, you know?
Good old Wilson Harris, Bill said. We call you Harris because we're so fond of you.
I say, Barnes, you don't know what this all means to me.
Come on and utilize another glass, I said.
Barnes, really, Barnes, you can't know. That's all.
Drink up, Harris.
We walked back down the road from Roncesvalles with Harris between us. We had lunch at the inn, and Harris went with us to the bus. He gave us his card with his address in London and his club and his business address, and as we got on the bus, he handed us each an envelope. I opened mine, and there were a dozen flies in it. Harris had tied them himself. He tied all his own flies.
"I say, Harris," I began.
"No, no,"
he said. He was climbing down from the bus.
"They're not first-rate flies at all. I only thought if you fished them sometime, it might remind you of what a good time we had."
The bus started. Harris stood in front of the post office. He waved. As we started along the road, he turned and walked back toward the inn.
"Say, wasn't that Harris nice?" Bill said.
"I think he really did have a good time."
"Harris, you bet he did."
"I wish he'd come into Pamplona."
"He wanted to fish."
"Yes. You couldn't tell how English would mix with each other anyway."
"I suppose not."
We got into Pamplona late in the afternoon, and the bus stopped in front of the Hotel Montoya. Out in the plaza, they were stringing electric light wires to light the plaza for the fiesta. A few kids came up when the bus stopped, and a customs officer for the town made all the people getting down from the bus open their bundles on the sidewalk. We went into the hotel, and on the stairs I met Montoya. He shook hands with us, smiling in his embarrassed way.
"Your friends are here," he said.
"Mr. Campbell?"
"Yes, Mr. Cohn and Mr. Campbell and Lady Ashley."
He smiled as though there was something I would hear about.
"When did they get in?"
"Yesterday. I've saved you the rooms you had."
"That's fine. Did you give Mr. Campbell the room on the plaza?"
"Yes, all the rooms we looked at."
"Where are our friends now?"
"I think they went to the pelota."
"And how about the bulls?"
Montoya smiled.
"Tonight," he said. "Tonight at 7 o'clock they bring in the VR bulls, and tomorrow come the Miuras. Do you all go down?"
"Oh, yes. They've never seen a desencajonada."
Montoya put his hand on my shoulder.
"I'll see you there."
He smiled again. He always smiled as though bullfighting were a very special secret between the two of us. A rather shocking but really very deep secret that we knew about. He always smiled as though there was something lewd about the secret to outsiders, but that it was something that we understood. It would not do to expose it to people who would not understand.
"Your friend, is he aficionado too?"
Montoya smiled at Bill.
"Yes, he came all the way from New York to see the San Fermines."
"Yes," Montoya politely disbelieved, "but he's not aficionado like you."
He put his hand on my shoulder again, embarrassedly.
"Yes," I said, "he's a real aficionado, but he's not aficionado like you are."
"Afición means passion. An aficionado is one who is passionate about the bullfights." All the good bullfighters stayed at Montoya's hotel. That is, those with afición stayed there. The commercial bullfighters stayed once, perhaps, and then did not come back. The good ones came each year. In Montoya's room were their photographs. The photographs were dedicated to Juanito Montoya, or to his sister. The photographs of bullfighters Montoya had really believed in were framed. Photographs of bullfighters who had been without afición, Montoya kept in a drawer of his desk. They often had the most flattering inscriptions, but they did not mean anything. One day Montoya took them all out and dropped them in the wastebasket. He did not want them around. We often talked about bulls and bullfighters. I had stopped at the Montoya for several years. We never talked for very long at a time. It was simply the pleasure of discovering what we each felt. Men would come in from distant towns and before they left Pamplona, stop and talk for a few minutes with Montoya about bulls. These men were aficionados. Those who were aficionados could always get rooms even when the hotel was full. Montoya introduced me to some of them. They were always very polite at first, and it amused them very much that I should be an American. Somehow it was taken for granted that an American could not have afición. He might simulate it or confuse it with excitement, but he could not really have it. When they saw that I had afición, and there was no password, no set questions that could bring it out, rather it was a sort of oral, spiritual examination with the questions always a little on the defensive and never apparent, there was this same embarrassed putting the hand on the shoulder, or a buen hombre. But nearly always there was the actual touching. It seemed as though they wanted to touch you, to make it certain. Montoya could forgive anything of a bullfighter who had afición. He could forgive attacks of nerves, panic, bad, unexplainable actions, all sorts of lapses. For one who had afición, he could forgive anything. At once he forgave me, all my friends. Without his ever saying anything, they were simply a little something shameful between us, like the spilling open of the horses in bullfighting. Bill had gone upstairs as we came in, and I found him washing and changing in his room.
"Well," he said, "talk a lot of Spanish."
He was telling me about the bulls coming in tonight.
"Let's find the gang and go down."
"All right. They'll probably be at the cafe."
"Have you got tickets?"
"Yes, I got them for all the unloadings."
"What's it like?"
He was pulling his cheek before the glass, looking to see if there were unshaved patches under the line of the jaw.
"It's pretty good," I said. "They let the bulls out of the cages one at a time, and they have steers in the corral to receive them and keep them from fighting. And the bulls tear in at the steers, and the steers run around like old maids trying to quiet them down."
"Do they ever gore the steers?"
"Sure, sometimes they go right after them and kill them."
"Can't the steers do anything?"
"No, they're trying to make friends."
"What do they have them in for?"
"To quiet down the bulls and keep them from breaking their horns against the stone walls or goring each other."
"Must be swell being a steer."
We went down the stairs and out of the door and walked across the square toward the Café Iruña. There were two lonely-looking ticket houses standing in the square. Their windows, marked Sol, Sol y Sombra, and Sombra, were shut. They would not open until the day before the fiesta. Across the square, the white wicker tables and chairs of the Iruña extended out beyond the arcade to the edge of the street. I looked for Brett and Mike at the tables. There they were, Brett and Mike and Robert Cohn. Brett was wearing a Basque beret, so was Mike. Robert Cohn was bareheaded and wearing his spectacles. Brett saw us coming and waved. Her eyes crinkled up as we came up to the table.
"Hello, you chaps," she called.
Brett was happy. Mike had a way of getting an intensity of feeling into shaking hands. Robert Cohn shook hands because we were back.
"Where the hell have you been?" I asked.
"I brought them up here," Cohn said.
"What rot?"
Brett said. "We'd have gotten here earlier if you hadn't come."
"You'd never have gotten here."
"What rot?
You chaps are brown. Look at Bill."
"Did you get good fishing?" Mike asked. "We wanted to join you."
"It wasn't bad. We missed you."
"I wanted to come," Cohn said, "but I thought I ought to bring them."
"You bring us? What rot?"
"Was it really good?" Mike asked. "Did you take many?"
"Some days we took a dozen apiece. There was an Englishman up there."
"Named Harris," Bill said. "Ever know him, Mike? He was in the war, too."
"Fortunate fellow," Mike said. "What times we had. How I wish those dear days were back."
"Don't be an ass."
"Were you in the war, Mike?" Cohn asked.
"Was I not?" He was a very distinguished soldier, Brett said. Tell them about the time your horse...